Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. Granny takes a trip. High fashion and high times at the Wildest Rock and Roll Boutique. This is the illuminating and colourful story of the boutique that dressed British rock and roll. I'm delighted to say that possibly the best dressed man I've ever had on this radio station joins me live on the line now with an impressive amount of vinyl behind him. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Paul Gorman. Paul, good morning to you.
Good to see you, Giles.
So, first of all, like the turntable, by the way, and the well-placed book.
Yes, exactly. You know, you've got to sell the garment, sweetie. That's what I think.
Exactly. Now, for those who don't know, now, I used to stomp up and down the King's Road in the 80s and 90s, and World's End has always been quite something, hasn't it? So explain a little bit about Granny Takes a Trip and what it actually meant to a sort of staid London at the time.
Well, it was really the first of those boutiques to break the mould of fashion retailing. Before that, just before that, and it's interesting because it was a reaction against it, was Carnaby Street.
Yeah.
The whole explosion in, that was really the first manifestation of fast fashion. You know, think of an idea for a pair of trousers on a Tuesday, have them made up by the Thursday, they're in the shop on the Friday nights when people have got their wage packets. These guys, the three of them, three young people, Nigel Weymouth, John Pierce, a trained tailor, and Nigel's girlfriend, Sheila Cohen, were interested in clothes from the past, a lot like younger people now. They're interested in reacting against fast fashion, and Sheila had built up a huge collection of antique clothing, as it was called then. This is the beginning of vintage, really. And so they needed a place to sell it. John came up with, as a trained tailor, ready-made and new shirts, jackets, trousers. Sheila handled women's wear, and Nigel created these incredible frontages. You know, variously, the facade had a pop art portrait of Jean Harlow. The only way you could see into the shop was through her parted lips.
Right.
At another point, there was a front end of John's Dodge American car, and that jutted out onto the pavement. And so this was a way of making fashion retailing exciting for youth.
So tell me, I mean, give me the geography, because I'm just thinking, you bomb down the King's Road, you go past, well, it's probably all changed, but there's the Man in the Moon pub on the corner there. You know,
Was it
American Classics used to be? What's the whereabouts is it?
Exactly. So that is the beginning of the area known as World's End. Named after King Charles II, apparently. He was visiting Nell Gwynn on this muddy track, and his carriage broke down.
Right.
And he said, "Odds gods," or whatever he said at the time, "we have to be in World's End." A tavern opened up there, and the area was pretty desolate at the time. When this trio of youngsters opened their shop there, it was pretty scrappy.
Yeah.
It was no wanted end of, it wasn't posh at all. There was a lot of social housing, a lot of slums about to be cleared, and they had the opportunity to open this extraordinary store in this area where the cost of entry was really low. Another parallel with today, whereas young people just can't get into this game. At that point, they have very little money, but they can afford the rent and afford to get the clothes made.
And so it's sort of the, you say it's a reaction to Carnaby Street, because presumably Carnaby Street is all sort of early, sort of mid-60s. It's all like the Kinks, it's all the gear, and everybody goes there.
Yeah.
And does it quickly sort of become, I mean, Carnaby Street now, nah. So therefore, does it quickly become almost the establishment of the anti-establishment, if you know what I'm saying?
Exactly. It began that fashion cycle, which we see now, where virtually every town and every city around the country had its own kind of Carnaby Street swinging London store. These guys were interested, as I say, in the clothes from the past and also quality clothing. And they were interested in music. And as the title of the shop announces, really, they were interested in mind-altering substances, which was very much part of the counterculture. So the granny comes from Sheila's granny's clothes, and Takes a Trip comes from their adventures in early drug culture. It was all quite innocent.
Yeah.
This was the counterculture in its prime, really. And so among the first customers were the Beatles. Well, John Lennon and Paul McCartney walked in. They wore the clothes on the back cover of Revolver within a few months. The Stones wore the clothes on that year's album, Between the Buttons. This is 1966. Pink Floyd were wearing the swirling patterns to go with their light shows at underground clubs such as UFO. Mm. And suddenly it takes off and it influences boutiques around the world. They realize that they have to have an interesting environment in which to sell clothes, where really the music is really totally melded with the fashion. It's the first, it's the beginnings of that story.
Because before then, it's all, are you being served, isn't it? And thank you, Mr. Grace. It's haberdashery and the third floor. You see, there's a bunch of people who are born after about 1980 going, I've got no idea what they're going on about. But it's, you know, third floor haberdashery, you know, women's, what's, yeah. and it's all, you know, I'm free, Mr. Grace. And like, you know what I'm saying, Captain Peacock? It's very staid. It's not fun. This coincides with the birth. I mean, I know we've had teenage culture since the bar attires of the late 50s, but this really puts a rocket under it.
It does, and it supercharges it, as you say, because it uses musicians, or musicians gravitate to it. And so I think it was Pete Townsend said, you know who's in town from America because they're going to Granny Takes a Trip. And so they're going home wearing these wild clothes. And suddenly you see in America little stores reacting to that because the kids want to wear the clothes that their heroes are wearing. And so it's supercharged the kind of communication of fashion as an integral part of the counterculture and youth lifestyle.
It's really interesting though, because you say we're talking at World's End, and the Guinness Flats just behind it in the World's End area, and places like Oakley Street, which is what, obviously, if you don't know, if listeners don't know, it's opposite the fire station in Chelsea. These are sort of Glebe Street. These aren't the areas that they are now. The Stones have got a place on Oakley Street, and it's really on Flood Street, and so this is like they're local. It's not like they're going down. The Satanic Majesties are coming down to check out this. This boutique is there for a long time. So it's just like popping around to see what's new, isn't it?
Yeah, and Chelsea always had the air of being a bohemian enclave.
Yeah.
And so Oscar Wilde lived there, the pre-Raphaelites gravitated there, the artists gravitated there because the light is very different. You're on the river and it's diffuse and it's reflected in the art of the late 19th century. And that was why really they set up there. The Chelsea Arts Club is there. One of the leading art schools, the Chelsea Art College, was there. It's now moved elsewhere. And so they felt like they were among their own, and they could experiment. The interesting thing is that they lasted 3 years in this relatively innocent experiment, which attracted everybody. And then this character, Freddie Hornick, arrived. He was 25 years old, and he bought the shop because they weren't interested anymore. They'd gone off into other things, making psychedelic posters or making films. And he then opens up a store in New York, a Granny Takes a Trip store in New York, one in Los Angeles. And there's a new wave of people, it's kind of glam, that rock peacock Keith Richards look is then sold velvet suits. Rod Stewart wears one of their suits when he's singing Maggie May on Top of the Pops. Mark Bolan wears them on in Performance.
Yeah.
And so it gets a second wave, which is less psychedelic and it's more rocker, as it were.
Is it a case where people like, you know, the Stones are going to Morocco? Because people, they're traveling now, and Morocco is like exotic, and they're coming back with this stuff. Because I'm looking at a picture. Is that Joanna Lumley in this sort of?
Yes.
I dropped my bacon sandwich, to be honest with you, Paul. Because she looks fabulous, but is she somewhere in the Maghreb or something? I mean,
you're quite right. She's in Marrakesh. It's for a fashion shoot. I don't know if you remember, but at the time she was a regular fashion model.
Yeah.
There would be shoots which had exotic locations which reflected the clothes. And so she's wearing a Granny Takes a Trip dress there on a shoot in Morocco. And it kind of reflects that internationalism, which is creeping in as well. It's no longer very British. There's a lot of influences of ethnic clothing and everything else, and vintage still coming in. And so the people in the book who wear the clothes. You know, it's a cast list from the 60s and 70s, from Twiggy, Joanna Lumley, Jane Asher. You know, there's Andy Warhol's set, wore it. Yeah. Lou Reed wore the clothes in performance on the cover of his album Transformer. The Stones wore the clothes and on the cover of Exile on Main Street. And so it really went international.
And you know how people go, oh, well, they're just shoehorning people in for diversity these days. It's all gone woke. But there's a quite brilliant picture of Christopher Lynch in this amazing double-breasted sort of jacket, which I absolutely adore.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Is it Christopher Lynch, the designer? Christopher Lynch.
Yes.
I mean,
yes,
and exactly. So it's not just because people can easily go, well, the 60s was just a sort of a white middle class art school experiment.
Yeah.
And Christopher Lynch definitely isn't a white middle class art school experiment.
No. I mean, he looks absolutely incredible. And in fact, when they opened in New York, you then get Miles Davis buying boots in the shop. Ooh. You then get the Isley Brothers wearing the clothes on the cover of 3+3. Sly Stone wore a suit. He didn't actually get married in it, but he wore a suit on his his wedding days. He had several costumes. But so you get a big black influence, which responds to the sort of blaxploitation look of the 70s. So Nile Rodgers says in the book that the people in New York City who dictated how you looked was Granny Takes a Trip. And he talks about going into the Harlem Apollo in a pair of snakeskin. I think he was wearing other clothes as well.
Yeah.
But snakeskin platform boots.
Well, if it's Studio 54, you're not quite sure, are you, Paul? I mean, you could get in with, you know, with a thong in the face.
You never know.
Sly probably did, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So what I was interested in was that it sort of broke out that little swinging London, very white, quite, you know, we all know that story.
Yeah.
And it made it international and it crossed barriers of class. A lot of posh people were involved in it, as well as a lot of working class people. Crossed barriers of class, colour, creed, and really made a difference. Of course, it all ended in tears, as all these things do.
Here's the thing, because if you have something that is quintessentially, you would think, London, South, you know, Chelsea, World's End, Does it transport well to the East? I can imagine doing okay in the East Coast because it's New York and it's Greenwich Village and they've got that folk things a lot. But places like the West Coast, are they going to go, well, we're not sure what's going on? And if you take a brand like that and you dilute it, I mean, you only have to, you know, you kind of run the danger of losing what makes it so eccentric and eclectic and compelling.
You do. And so that's why Freddie, by the time he owned the shop and he had London, New York and Los Angeles, he realised that English tailoring and style had cultural equity as long as you kept it tight, as long as you kept it in small outlets where the hip people could go. But in a way, I lived in Los Angeles, and actually an English accent goes a long way. And so in a way, you look at what is happening with Oasis now. My niece was a gig in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. It's incredible because they are so British. You wouldn't have thought it would go off, but it didn't before. But now their very Britishness is the thing that is attracting people in America. So I see parallels there as well.
So when does it all, because I mean, you mentioned the Beatles go in on this on the opening days and they wear stuff on Revolver. Yeah. And 66 is a great year for that. It's the turning point before we get Sgt. Pepper. And then the sort of 68, it all goes completely sort of the psychedelics kick in a bad way. So
yeah.
I'm just thinking, so the Beatles come in 66 and they have a look at it and they really like it. Do you think this sort of places the genesis of the idea of hey Ringo, we could have a clothes shop as well? What could possibly go wrong?
Yes, exactly. And it did go wrong because my book also covers the fellow travellers, as it were.
Yeah.
And one of those fellow travellers was a guy called John Crittle, amazing Australian larrikin, you know, really brave and interested in revolutionising the way people dressed. He opened a shop called Dandy Fashion. Mm-hmm. The Beatles were keen fans of the shop. Eventually, when they start opening the Apple Empire up, they bought the shop and he managed it and they turned it into Apple Tailoring. And it's interesting to track it. It only lasted 3 months because the kids who hung around the shop and hung around the Beatles didn't want tailoring. You know, they wanted youth fashions, as it were, but the Beatles are maturing. And so you get loads of these sort of quixotic business experiments, which, like I say, often end in tears, but they're very exciting for that moment. You know, they express the excitement of the moment.
Does it have a knock-on effect? Because you've got this going on, you know, Granny Takes a Trip and whatever, and then you've got Savile Row, and it's Row, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, but you've got Tommy Nutter, who is, yeah. I mean, does Nutter get influenced by, do you think, by what's happening there?
Definitely, because of John's apprenticeship at Savile Row Tailors. Those guys in Savile Row, particularly the younger ones, there's Rupert Lysett-Green, who's got blades. There's Mr. Fish, Michael Fish, who invented the man dress where, you know, Bowie wears it on the cover of his album, Man Who Sold the World, and Jagger wears it in Hyde Park. They're all not keeping their eye, but they're responding. It's a bit of that action-reaction that happens in fashion. So these guys are younger. They want to shake up Savile Row, which is where they come from. And so you see Granny's influence infiltrating every sphere of particularly menswear and the way we look. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, not only because it's a cracking story and you know it's got elements of comedy and tragedy involved in it, but also it's so influential. And then it closed in 1980 after a massive drugs bust. The originals were no longer involved, but it was splashed on the front of the News of the World, so it crashed and burned. And ever since then, it's been thought of in the way that I don't think it should be thought of. I thought it was really influential, and I thought it was an important book to write about our visual identity today.
Because the thing is, with a name like that, and people think, oh, it's just a bunch of, you know, stoned hippies falling out of the thing and, you know, knitting their own woad, you know.
It doesn't help. And, you know, for sure that was happening as well. I mean, there's a story that the manager of the LA store tells about Keith Moon coming in to buy...
Well, that's all you need to say, isn't it, basically? I mean, come on, Keith Moon comes in, that's it, you know, end of story. Yeah.
But he's buying an outfit for the Oscars that night. He wants to meet Harry Nilsson at the after-show party.
Oh, blimey.
He spends 5 hours there, can't make his mind up. Eventually, at 10 o'clock, when the parties are all going, he settles on an outfit and tries to pay with half a credit card because he'd left the other half in his flat in London.
Right.
And eventually, Roger, the manager, just went, just go forth in peace.
Go forth in peace. But things Granny Takes a Trip, you can argue that there's no, and ladies and gentlemen, if of a nervous disposition, there's no sex in terms of the shop itself. And so therefore, there's no Malcolm McLaren, there's no Vivienne Westwood, there's no punk movement, there's no pistols. And basically, the whole British counterculture could almost grind to a halt around about 1975.
Yeah, well, I think you're right, because I wrote the biography of Malcolm and I knew him quite well.
Yeah.
And although he didn't like Granny's and the way in which it approached it, he was reacting against it.
Yeah.
And so they proved that you could open sort of pop-up shop is how we would recognise it. Overnight, they would change the exterior into something really shocking. And that's what Malcolm did with his stores with Vivienne Westwood, in that he was trained as an art student. These were almost environmental installations. You went in there, it was quite threatening. And also Granny's was, you know, Salman Rushdie lived upstairs for the summer of 1967 as a shy Cambridge student, went downstairs to say hi and said, look, I'm living upstairs, can we have a conversation? And Sheila Cohen said, don't you know conversation's dead, man, and shut the door in his face. And so they could be quite exclusive as well. And so there's something of their DNA in what happened subsequently with the punk stores that we know now. And also right up into the new romantic stores like World's End, in the same place at 430 Kings Road, which is still open today.
With the clock, is that what you said, the clock? No, this shows my age, clock game.
It's still there, 13-hour clock spinning backwards. But, you know, I don't think Malcolm would have come up with that idea in that way without having noticed what Granny's was doing in the previous decade.
There are still some people are still around who were there. They didn't all sort of Keith Moon themselves into a frenzy.
No. Nigel Wayans, we had a book launch last week in London and reunited. Sadly, Sheila died in 2010, but we reunited John, who's still a tailor, still working very well, got really top-notch clients and some young artists like Celeste makes clothes for her. And we reunited him with Nigel Weymouth.
Wow.
They were co-founders. And it was quite a moment, actually. It was quite interesting to see them together and kind of celebrate them as well. And so they're still at it. Well, yeah, Nigel's still making psychedelic posters. John's making suits, and a few of the other people who ran the LA and New York stores, I'm going to New York next week to launch it there. They're still around as well. They're coming along to that launch.
And here's the thing, because they're not in it for the quick buck. You know, they're not, you know, they're still designing posters. They are good at what they do. It's not like I'm doing a pop-up show, we're doing vapes, and then we'll get out of here, you know. Well, exactly. You know, and still telling you. So they've learned the craft. They're good at what they do. And I just got this vision of that must have been like a psychedelic Jurassic Park moment as they strode in across, you know, the entrance.
Yeah, that's true. I think, you know, lots of people have said when you walked across that entrance, you came out changed, you know, it changed your life in a way. But also I think that, like you say, they weren't interested in a quick buck. Those that died sadly without much money. But what they were interested in was making a statement. And they didn't do it through music like the Stones and the Beatles. They did it through visual culture and clothes, posters, artworks, designs.
The book is called Granny Takes a Trip, High Fashion and High Times at the Wildest Rock and Roll Boutique. It's by Paul Gorman, who is speaking today. Listeners, you can, if you click on the link on our virtual bookstore, a well-known delivery company named after a South American river will deliver it to you. Just go and buy it for the Joanna Lumley picture on its own, I think, not to mention the fabulous writer. Paul, if people want to follow you before you hightail it to New York, where's the best place to find you on social media and say nice things?
I'm on Instagram, Paul Gorman. You'll find me there. If you look me up there.
Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. The book is called Granny Takes a Trip, High Fashion and High Times at the Wildest Rock and Roll Boutique. Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Good to speak to you, Giles.